All right, thank you guys for leading us. If you want to go ahead and turn to Job chapter 38, we will be jumping back into that section of our study today. I think by way of introduction, I'll just kind of catch us up to where we are and give indication of where we're headed. Obviously, we have found ourselves at this climactic moment in the entire narrative in which the Lord himself shows up on the scene and begins to speak from the whirlwind, this scene of a weather disturbance of significant magnitude, the kind that would bring an element of fear and awe to any human observer. And yet it is the very veil of the Lord's presence, and out of that event he begins to speak. And certainly this is the climactic moment in the entire narrative in which we are going to get what we've been longing for. We are starting to get, I should say, what we've been longing for. Job is going to receive what he has been longing for. It's just quite compelling to recognize and be reminded once again that what he receives and what we are seeing might not necessarily be what we thought we were entitled to receive, or maybe what we thought were the questions we needed to have answered. And so this has been a really compelling study already, at least for me, and I hope for you as well. We simply began our discussion of this section by looking at the first few verses, and we just sort of gave a heading to that, and we just called it the dramatic appearance, just noting how the Lord spoke to Job out of the whirlwind and the various ways that he spoke to him and called him to dress for action and be prepared for this particular engagement. But then we moved to last week to discuss what we called the divine audience. And I basically encapsulated that heading around a very large section of this final climactic portion of the entire narrative. In chapter 38, verse 4, all the way through verse 2 of chapter 40, I'm encompassing that and calling that the divine audience. As we talked about last week, this is to distinguish what is happening here from what Job was calling for. We talked about last week, we listed off several passages in which Job repeatedly begged God, cried out to God for a hearing, for basically a trial before the righteous and perfect judge. And with a certain confidence and certainty that if he only had that opportunity, then he would be vindicated. And all these accusations that have been hurled against him by his so-called counselors would be proven to be in error. And all he needed was for God to give him that hearing. And so the scene, or maybe the vision that Job was articulating, was one of sort of a courtroom and a trial. But what he is actually experiencing now, we're calling a divine audience, which is very, very different than a trial. In a trial, you might have a defendant, and in this case, an actually innocent defendant, who has an opportunity to sort of plead his case, to voice his innocence, and to maybe present evidence line by line, accusation by accusation, that proves the accuser in error. And what we find here is not that at all. In fact, we find what we, as I've said, called a divine audience, because a divine audience, if you think of a monarchy setting where someone gets to come before the high king of the court and of the nation, and the real setting there is not one in which someone gets to prattle on articulating their woes and their grievances, but mainly it is an opportunity for them to maybe be heard, but mostly to listen. And so that's what we see happening here. This is not a trial that Job envisioned, but it is rather this divine audience. Now, as I said, as sort of a technical or structural note from last week, this divine audience continues on beyond the section that we're giving this particular heading to. And we're doing that to just distinguish it, to kind of get us started thinking rightly about the scene. But also, we're going to kind of emphasize something else as we move into the second half of this particular narrative and this particular divine audience. We're only going to call this first half the divine audience. And as I said, it's a scene in which Job has been granted the privilege to stand before the Lord, but mostly the privilege of standing before the Lord, not to be heard, but to listen. And that's what's happening here. In fact, Job chapter 38, the second part of verse 3, the Lord says, "I will question you, and you make it known to me." And of course, as we saw, we read the entire section, right? And as we saw the Lord questioning Job, question after question after question, in a bit of a relentless kind of fashion. Now, this divine audience, we are going to break it down into sort of two sections. The first section we looked at some length and detail last week, and we just called that the mysterious grandeur of inanimate creation. This is how the Lord proceeds to communicate with Job. He lays before Job what is the great mysteries of creation that point to the glory and power of God. This is chapter 38, verses 4 through verse 38. We looked last week, for example, at the vast dimensions and depth of the earth's foundations in verses 4 to 7. We looked at how the Lord speaks of the determined limits of the expansive and untamable seas in verses 8 to 11 of chapter 38. We also noted how the Lord speaks of His command and control over the cycles of day and night in verses 12 to 15 of chapter 38. We then noted in verses 16 to 21 this casual expression of the Creator and His omnipresence and His omniscience. The language is just almost matter-of-fact casual, and only God can speak of things like omnipresence and omniscience in such a casual fashion. He's just describing Himself and His capacity to go where He wants to or to be where He wants to be at any given point in time. And to know all things. And there's no sort of accumulation of knowledge, and there's no sort of traveling from here to there. He is in the depths. He understands the depths of Hades and hell. He knows the heights. He's circumferenced all things. And then we looked at how the Lord speaks of His sovereign control over the celestial realm as He speaks of these constellations. Really, in terms of Him seizing control, He speaks of clasping Orion's belt, for example, and these celestial bodies, these constellations, speaking of them as though He just sort of has them in His grip. And that was in verses 31 to 38 of chapter 38. And we also looked at the purposeful governance of weather patterns and atmospheric disturbances that He speaks of. He even talks about His use of the hail for the time of battle. That the things that we look at and seem random or sort of spring up, weather disturbances that sort of spring up, and maybe we can have some predictive capability a few days out, the Lord is purposing these things, controlling them and purposing them. So today we want to turn our attention to this second portion of this divine audience, in which the Lord describes His meticulous management of animate creation. We saw the grandeur of inanimate creation, of sort of non-living being creation, the depths of the earth, the heights of the heavens, the celestial bodies, the weather. But in this second half, this next section, we see Him addressing and speaking to Job about His providential control and His management over animate creation, and in particular, animals. He gets into the animal world, the animal kingdom. We see the Lord shift here, His focus, from this grand scope of the depths of the earth and the heights of the heavens to what you might just call a more accessible earthly plane, sort of a plane that is well within man's natural field of vision. It's a meaningful shift in the Lord's focus and how He's presenting Himself and His power and His authority to Job. In this opening section, we saw how the Lord expressed His eternal power and His authority by describing what you just might call massive things, big things, things that we look at and go, yeah, that's big. I can't get my arms around that for sure. I can't grab hold of Orion's buckle. That's pretty clear. He shifts from this focus in describing massive things in creation that are clearly beyond man's reach, but he describes them, if you recall, as though they were mundane and small. So that was his approach to getting Job's attention about his power and his authority and the scope of his power and authority, describing things that from the perspective of man is just beyond our grasp, beyond our capability of imagining that kind of control. And yet for him, it's as if it were nothing. Here, he will go to what you might say are comparatively small things. Things that are within man's dominion on the earth, in fact. And he does this to put an even finer point on this constant reality for us, that we are limited and God is not. He's even going to bring this down into a field of vision where we can say, I've seen that. I know that animal. I know the characteristics of that beast. But he's going to use what is accessible to man and in his domain to put an even finer exclamation point on the reality of our limitations and the lack of limitations that he has. And so first, we've already read this entire section last week, so we'll just kind of break it down piece by piece this week as opposed to reading the entirety of it. The first thing that we'll notice in this next little turn here is the provision of sustenance for the fierce predator and the lowly scavenger. The provision of sustenance for the fierce predator and the lowly scavenger. You see this in chapter 38, verses 39 to 41. After he finishes talking about all these grand things and the celestial bodies and the weather patterns and all of that, he then shifts and he says in verse 39, "Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their thicket? Who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God for help and wander about for lack of food?" A couple years ago, Joel and Kelly Teague and Alicia and I had an opportunity to go to Nairobi, Kenya to spend some time with our missionary partners there and to do some teaching. And on our last day of our time there, before we had to head to the airport to catch a late flight that final night to begin that long journey home, we decided that we were going to go to the Nairobi National Park, which is this large national park with open spaces and some very fascinating animals that you might be able to see if you're fortunate. And so we decided on that final day to do that. In order to be able to have an opportunity to see some of these animals, you had to get there before sunrise. And so you begin to sort of make your, and you're just driving on these roads, on these dirt roads in this massive national park. And you begin driving on this dirt road and driving slowly and driving by light of only the headlights of your vehicle, not knowing what you're going to see, not knowing what you might come across your path. And so there's this sort of this sense of both anticipation and kind of an uh-oh kind of thing, like looming uh-oh, that you kind of feel as you're making this drive. And I'll never forget, the shortly after sunrise, I believe it was, if I recall correctly, it was one of the first things we encountered were these two ginormous rhinos just hanging out on the side of this dirt road that we were driving on through this national park. And I remember experiencing a bit of an adrenaline rush, as you might imagine. Because, you know, you're not at the zoo. I mean, they could move back, they could come at you. I mean, they're out there. And so you just kind of feel this sort of this rush, you know, when you see them and you just sort of slowly drive past them. And as we continued our drive through the park, we saw giraffes and zebras and even some antelope on the road. And that was fun. It really was. It was, you know, just exciting. But I will never forget the rush of excitement mixed with some trepidation when we saw a huge lioness sitting in the grass right off the side of the road. All I know is that hit different. Seeing that animal in open space like that, was quite memorable and unique. And I looked at some photos that we took of this of these animals. I looked at some photos of this lioness this morning, and I immediately remembered the beauty and the fierceness that was just sort of all encompassing that animal as she sat there, laying down, head up, looking out across the field in this low grass. It was almost like a, you know, like a postcard kind of situation. It really was. I'm pretty sure it was real, too. I don't think it was a... Yeah. No, it was real. And it struck me. Like, it struck me differently than the zebra or the antelope, for sure. Even the rhino, although that was pretty intimidating. But here in verses 39 to 40, the Lord points to the lioness. It says lion, but it's really the lioness. This is a fierce and cunning hunter that he is describing here, that he is pointing to. Lioness can reach speeds of up to 50 miles per hour, and it can take down animals 2 to 3 times its own size. 5 to 10 times its own size if it's hunting in a group, which they normally do. We're talking a fierce, effective, efficient, strong, capable hunter. And he's speaking to Job and saying to him, can you do this thing? Are you capable of hunting the prey for the lion? Now, what do you think Job's answer is going to be to that question? Of course not, right? This is a powerful picture for us. Job, can you do that? Do you have any power or prerogative to ensure that the lions and the lion cubs are fed? No. And then he turns to what I just thought in my mind, and forgive me if this is, I don't know, disrespectful to the text, but I think you'll understand. He turns to what struck me as sort of this Lion King circle of life kind of moment. Because he turns to the raven. And a raven is a small, like by comparison to the lioness, right, is this small scavenger bird, whose sustenance is actually dependent upon the leftovers from predators like the lioness. That's the type of creature that we're talking about here. He goes from this fierce hunter. Can you hunt the prey for this predator, Job? I think not. Or what about the entire cycle of life, the way that I provide for all animals of all types, including a scavenger, including what would have been considered an unclean animal, in fact? He gets more specific even in this part of the text because he says in verse 41, who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God for help and wander about for lack of food? Who is it that these young ones, these young ravens, these helpless, hungry ravens, who is it that they're crying out to for food? Well, of course, the implication here, actually the explicit reference here, is that they're crying out to me, Job. Not you. Not you and me. Not Job. They're crying out to the Lord God. The lioness is a fierce hunter. The raven is a scavenger. Their sustenance is governed by my hand, as far different as they may be. I love what Elmer Smick, by the way, I mentioned his name yesterday in my counseling conference session. What a great theologian's name, right? Elmer Smick, commentator of Job, he says, I think this is such a great understatement, one of these profound understatements. He says, it has never crossed Job's mind to hunt prey for lions or to stuff food into the outstretched gullets of the raven's nestlings. But are not their growls and squawks cries to God on whom all these creatures ultimately depend? In other words, the Lord is pointing to something that would have never crossed any human being's mind as possible, as reasonable, as wise, as in the purview of their responsibility or their dominion. Never would they, would anyone think of that. But the Lord is highlighting these things to point to Job to say, these are creatures that depend upon me for their sustenance, Job. Psalm 147, 7 and 9 says this, sing to the Lord with thanksgiving. Make melody to God on the lyre. He covers the heavens with clouds. He prepares the rain for the earth. He makes grass grow on the hills. He gives to the beasts their food and to the young ravens that cry. That's our God. Well, the next thing he turns to help Job understand what he needs to understand, he turns to what I'm just calling the unaided life cycles of untamed creatures. The unaided life cycles of untamed creatures in chapter 39, verses 1 to 4. He says, do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth? When they crouch, bring forth their offspring, and are delivered to their young? Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go out and do not return to them. So this is the Lord pointing to a different animal, a different type of animal, an animal with very different characteristics. And we might ask ourselves, well, okay, what's the significance here? Well, one thing for sure is that very much unlike domesticated livestock, which, remember, Job was a man of great wealth in the form of livestock. You remember that, right? So the Lord is pointing to things that Job would have some familiarity with, or at least a point of reference for comparison. And so unlike domesticated livestock, as well as humans, as well as Job, as well as you and me, this mountain goat, or the ibex is what it would be referred to, what would be known as, they require absolutely no assistance and certainly no human intervention when giving birth or caring for their offspring. That's what he's saying. This is an animal that does not need any assistance from anyone. But it's interesting to think about this particular species and how this might draw out other points of application. Just a little information about this particular animal. Ibex are masters of extreme terrain. They can scale nearly vertical cliffs and even man-made structures like dams with ease. You've seen these, right? Like, they're kind of standing on the side of a straight face, almost. Like, you're just looking at that and going, wait, what? That's what these animals can do. Their sharp cloven hooves have concave undersides that act like suction cups, providing grip on smooth rock, while their strong legs allow them to jump up to 6 feet straight up without a running start. Isn't that crazy? Ibex offspring, called kids, by the way, you know that, right? They stand within hours of their birth and can jump on the first day. They walk efficiently within a few days and follow their mother almost immediately, often within 1 to 2 days, even on those steep cliffs. This is what the Lord's talking about. This is my ibex. This is what I made. This is what the thing that I made is capable of without your assistance, Job. Even the offspring, even what in the mind of most people would be immediately conjuring up dependence, vulnerability, weakness. Not the ibex and not their kids. They're hopping around on cliff sides within 1 to 2 days of being born, Job. I mean, this is just a staggering use of God's intimate knowledge of his own creation to make a very poignant and compelling point to Job. Well, the next thing he points to, and this is just gets very interesting as we continue to move forward. The next thing he points to is what I'll just call the enviable freedom of the wild donkey. The enviable freedom of the wild donkey. In 39 verses 5 to 8, he says, who has let the wild donkey go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift donkey? to whom I have given the arid plain for his home and the salt land for his dwelling place. He scorns the tumult of the city. He hears not the shouts of the driver. He ranges the mountains as his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. There's sort of a whimsical tone here in this particular section. Commentators actually sort of agree on this. It's funny how many commentaries disagree on a lot of things in Job. It's almost interesting to see all the disagreements around, you know, what this ancient Hebrew term might actually mean, or should this section really go in this place, and who really is the speaker here? Is it Job or is it Zophar? I mean, those kinds of things, all kinds of debates that go on with this book. But most people agree that this definitely has somewhat of a light or whimsical tone associated with it. It's this description of the wild donkey. This wild donkey, which you may not know, would be the free and unfettered cousin of the normal understanding of a beast of burden, the normal donkey. Like, there is this wild donkey, the species of wild donkey that has freedom, that the domesticated beast of burden that Job would be very familiar with does not have. And he's pointing to this freedom, this provision of freedom that the Lord has given to this particular creation. John Hartley, and one commentator, says this. He says, the wild donkey frolics about these wastelands, laughing at the tumult in the marketplace, where its domesticated counterpoint toils long and hard beneath the heavy loads. He's almost like ascribing to this wild donkey, like, look at me, I'm just free, and, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's a waste, barren land out here, but look at me. I'm free, and you're carrying a load for your owner. He says, it is delighted that it does not have to obey a driver's loud shout, forcing it to move against his will. Nevertheless, its freedom comes at the price of having to range the barren hills far and wide in search of anything green. God watches over the wild donkey, making sure that it enjoys its freedom amid scarcity. Just another picture of God's providential management and oversight and care for his creation, giving Job another picture that would certainly resonate with him. In other words, when Job would think about a domesticated beast of burden, who knows how many of those he probably owned and made use of, and compares it to this wild donkey species that he probably was also familiar with, I'm quite certain, just like you and I, he would never think of this being an important part of God's design and purpose, and part of his management of his creation. The Lord continues to try to draw Job down to the fine point here. And the next thing he points us to is what I'll just refer to as the unsubdued strength of the wild ox. The unsubdued strength of the wild ox. You see this in chapter 39, verses 9 to 12. He says, is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will he spend the night at your manger? Can you bind him in the furrow with ropes? Or will he harrow the valleys after you? Will you depend on him because his strength is great? And will you leave to him your labor? Do you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? This is likely a reference to a beast called an aurox. Aurochs. It's spelled A-U-R-O-C-H-S, aurochs. This is a bovine species, cattle, if you think of a bovine species, that actually died off in the 17th century. So there's records of this, there's drawings of this. I mean, this is a known animal. This is not some kind of one. When we say extinct, I don't mean like, you know, we have some speculative bone fragments that people have built a whole model around. This is a known animal of size and scope and measure and habitat and all of that, okay? Now, this is probably what you might just refer to as the wild progenitor of all kinds of cattle, all domesticated cattle, in fact. And again, going back to Job's primary source of wealth, land and livestock, was the sort of the primary assets that were part of his holdings. And so he would have been familiar both with this animal, likely, as well as just the broader category of cattle and livestock. And so the comparison for him and the point that the Lord is making would probably be very resonant with him. These animals were enormous by comparison to common cattle. A bull aurochs was huge. Now, listen to this, surpassing 6 feet in breadth at the shoulders. So 6 feet across at the shoulders. Like about as tall as me, I'm a little more than 6 feet across this animal. It had long horns that pointed forward, a dark brown or black coat. Its horns combined with its brute strength made this animal very dangerous and completely untamable. So it was distinguished from domesticated livestock. No one could tame this animal. Domesticated oxen that are referred to in Scripture, we know of these, and even other cattle could be yoked, they could be put to the plow, and they could be led to a feeding trough. You notice he speaks of a manger. Will this thing lie down by your manger? That's a feeding trough. So these cattle that Job would have been familiar with can be done. He's done it. But not this. Not the wild oxen. No human could harness this animal in this way, but God can. At will. And then he takes us to what I'm just going to call the purposeful absurdity of the ostrich. It's the best I could do. The purposeful absurdity of the ostrich. Chapter 39, verses 13 to 17, he says, "The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions and plumage of love?" Just so you know, that phrase, and particularly that final word, love, is not certain. That's one of those words in the text of Job that no one really knows exactly what it means. It's an ancient term, and there's no corollary in a more contemporary, you know, body of literature that people can be certain about what this term is. So this particular first verse, I'm not going to try to venture a guess about what he's talking about when he's talking about the pinions and plumage of love. Okay. It's just not accessible to us. But the text goes on in verse 14, "For she leaves her eggs to the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that the wild beasts may trample them. She deals cruelly with her young as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, she has no fear, because God has made her forget wisdom and given her no share in understanding. When she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider." Now, this is a very interesting little section, is it not? You've got this creature that seems to be described in rather unfavorable terms, right? Again, referring to my friend Elmer Smick, here's what he says. He says, "The ostrich has a tiny brain, but is well programmed with instincts that assure its survival. The seeming cruelty to her young derives from the practice of driving off the yearlings when mating season arrives. The ostrich has exceptional eyesight, the largest of any land animal with 360-degree vision. But the text concentrates on the bird's most incongruous feature, tremendous legs. One kick can tear open a lion or a man. The lesson is that God can and does make creatures that appear odd and crazy to us if doing so pleases him." That's as good as anything for an interpretation. He does what he pleases, right? The Lord is in the heavens, he does what he pleases. He goes on to say, "Imagine a bird that can't fly, though it has wings. It can run faster than a horse." Like, okay, so we've got a bird. It has wings. It has what does it say, plumes and pinions, or pinions and plumage, as the ESV translates? Small brain, small head on a long neck, long legs, but it can't fly, but it can run really fast. Job cannot understand what God is doing in his life, and God is telling him the created world is just as difficult to rationalize. Maybe that's the point. Certainly the point is that the Lord, even something like an ostrich, to whom the Lord himself says, the reason why he does this is because he hasn't really been given much understanding. That's the reference to the tiny brain. He's not a wise creature. Okay? But he's still the Lord's. He's still the Lord's creature. And again, the sweep of all this is to just flood the zone in Job's heart and mind that you are now in the presence of the Almighty, God of heaven and earth and all creatures great and small and not so smart. That's who you're in the presence of. That's who you have this audience with. Well, the ostrich scene kind of gives us a little bit of a transition too, because it says when she rouses herself to flee, verse 18, she laughs at the horse and his rider. And then he turns his attention to the majestic fearlessness of the warhorse. The majestic fearlessness of the warhorse in chapter 39, verses 19 to 25. Speaking to Job directly, he says, "Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrifying. He paws in the valley and exults in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He does not turn back from the sword. Upon him rattle the quiver, the flashing spear and the javelin. With fierceness and rage, he swallows the ground. He cannot stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, he says, 'Aha!' He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of the captains and the shouting." This is just a picture of a very well-trained and very well-seasoned warhorse who is majestic and powerful and fearless. The sights and sounds and weaponry of war do not shake him. He is unstartled by the sound of the trumpet. In fact, he is invigorated by it. This is what his skills have been trained and honed for. A powerful creature, a majestic creature, a fearless creature, and one in which men of that day would recognize as indispensable in that kind of warfare. You probably have, if you've studied history, or maybe you've watched a movie, if you haven't studied history, and you know you see those scenes in which battles would take place on big fields and people would just sort of come toward each other with weaponry. And there was always a distinct advantage and major strategy employed when it came to the riders. Those who were mounted on steeds, right? There was a decided advantage. There was even calculations made about the numbers of mounted warriors that the opponent had versus you and how we might be able to contend with that. So he's describing this creature, this majestic warhorse, in terms that really would compel someone in Job's time to sort of stand in awe a little bit, to have a due respect for this type of creature. It also serves as a very stark contrast to the ostrich. You see that, right? In this whole narrative flow. We're not talking about a creature that has a small brain and looks kind of strange and does weird things and, you know, doesn't necessarily take the best care of its offspring. This is a totally different picture. You notice that he kind of goes back and forth to these contrasts. And he's making the point that all of this is mine. I govern all of them. Francis Anderson in his commentary says this. He says, "Can you make such an animal," speaking to Job, "can you control him? Even the well-broken and best-trained mount might break from the restraints of the most skilled rider. So that even the one domesticated animal included in the list is not completely under the control of man. And is man more free than any beast to be understood as struggling against the reins of God when stirred up as Job was?" So even here you have a domesticated animal, but he's not always controllable and containable. at least not by us. And then he closes out this section as he basically provides this menagerie of his created animals. And he speaks of the winged dominance of birds of prey in chapter 39, verses 26 to 30. The winged dominance of birds of prey. He says in verse 26, he says, Is it by your understanding, Job, that the hawk soars and spreads his wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the rock he dwells and makes his home, on the rocky crag and stronghold. From there he spies out the prey. His eyes behold him, behold it from afar. His young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there is he. So this is just another picture of majestic creatures, of powerful creatures of the air. So he's just basically moving to all places and points in his human line of sight, field of vision, created world in the animal kingdom. Now he takes Job to the skies. These birds, especially the eagle, are often referred to as the lion of the sky. That's sort of the nature of this particular creature. Hawks and eagles with their massive wingspans and their capability of flying at unbelievable heights. Their eyesight to be able to spot prey from so far away, it's hard to even fathom. And to swoop down and capture them and provide food for their offspring. It is a wonder. A wonder. And yet all this is under the command and providential control and management of the living God. Job and you and I just have to stand back in awe of what God manages, of what God has control over, that we absolutely don't. I like what David Klein says in sort of summation of this entire section discussing these animals. He says, the focus here is not on animals well known and useful to humans like sheep and donkeys and camels, but to those that are rather useless, mysterious, or hostile. These too are part of God's creation. It is the same with suffering. Sometimes, indeed, it may have a recognizable purpose, but sometimes it may just be as enigmatic and hurtful to humans as the wild animals can be. Nevertheless, it is part of God's order for the world, and He knows what He is doing in creating it. This is what the Lord's message is. Where were you? Have you done these things? Do you manage this creature? Can you subdue this beast? He's pointing to mystery and to power in the created world, and he's comparing that to his power, and there just is no comparison, and we have to stand in awe. And he gets to this penetrating question in chapter 40, verses 1 to 2, and the Lord said to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." So we come to this point, almost like a little bit of a break point. It's almost like you're at a seminar and it's like, you know, we need a 10-minute break. We need a health break here, right? So he comes to this break point and he asks this probing question. And we actually get an answer from Job. This is the first time Job speaks up, sort of. This penetrating question is basically a question of Job, any questions? Do you have anything to say at this point? Identifying him as a fault finder, do you want to contend? I mean, now's your hearing. You want to plead your case, Job? But then we have Job's, the third point here in our broader outline. We obviously have the dramatic appearance, the divine audience, and here we have the discerning acknowledgement. This is point number three in the broader outline, the discerning acknowledgement. Chapter 40, verses 3 to 5. Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer. Twice, but I will proceed no further." Good answer, Job. Well done. This is what I was referring to last week. This is the proper response in the presence of the Almighty. I have nothing to say. I'm speechless. I put my hand over my mouth. Even if in my flesh I were to blurt out something, far be it from me to do such a thing. This is a discerning acknowledgement on Joe's part that there is nothing, nothing to be said in the presence of the Almighty. We'll turn the corner next week and we'll begin to look at the decisive authority that the Lord puts on display as we move forward in the text. But let's pray for now.